Excuse me, one figures I have seen for the communes in Brussels, which your figures of the vote, the votes doesn't bring out, is that if you go back to the 1920s, in fact, the communes there were not communes in the south, were very much Dutch speaking, which have now become Francophone communes. That's one, that's a sorry.
And I can also try and explain.
My second question is one of the things about Brussels that is very interesting, and this would be impression more than anything else, is that in the federal government, the representation of the Landophones is much higher than it is of the French speakers, so that in fact, Brussels by day might be 50-50, but Brussels by night is probably something like 80-20, or maybe, say 80-20. Do you have any comments on that?
I'll take the first question first, and then move on to the second one.
It's something I did not mention, but I slightly touched upon, briefly touched upon the economic situation, the difference in the fairly prosperous situation of Wallonia up until the 1950s and 60s, and the relatively less prosperous situation in Flanders up until that time. And there has been substantial migration of Flemish people to Wallonia for economic reasons. And as quite a few scholars have noted, it is no accident that many speakers of French these days in Wallonia have Dutch sounding names. Mm. And those tend to be children and grandchildren of migrants who have moved to Wallonia for economic reasons. And what happened there is what happens in many comparable sociolinguistic situations. We have a situation of language contact. The first generation still speaks the mother tongue and acquires the new language, raises the children mainly in the new language, in French, and the children still understand Dutch for communication in the home context. And the grandchildren completely shift, or almost completely shift, towards French and still have a passive knowledge of Dutch. I'm oversimplifying, but that's basically the model. You start with the dominant in one language, you acquire a second, and you end up with a minor knowledge of your ancestor's first language, and you are proficient and dominant in the other language. So that's something which definitely did happen, and especially in industrial centres, there was a serious influx of speaking Dutch for economic reasons. The second element is the contrast, if I got it well, between the political representation of speakers of Dutch.
Yeah, it's more the fact that the train services in Brussels from France are very efficient, and large numbers, I think, of government civil servants come in on those trains. They change the balance, linguistic balance, during the day. They go home at night when you have a different...
Exactly. I refer to the repartition 1/3, 2/3 in the official administration. Maybe I can say that this is not fair, but again, that was part of an overall compromise. And you can have your own personal point of view on whether you think this is a good idea or not, but compromises typically are give and take. And that apparently was what one was able to agree upon back then. The tricky thing with the compromise, of course, is that you need to stick to it. And 10 years onwards, 20 years onwards, 30 years onwards, the compromise is still there. And what we see nowadays, in the present generation of politicians, at both sides of the linguistic border, but especially at the Flemish side of the linguistic border, where certain tendencies towards radicalization can be noted, it's no coincidence that a nationalist party overtly won the local elections, the communal elections, and will probably get a very good result at the next elections. That party, among others, thinks that it's time to be discussing other things. We've had the compromise for quite a long time. Let's look at these things again, once again. And you get a reaction at the other side of the language, no, we will not talk about this. You have radicalization at both sides. In practice, the fact that the number of speakers of Dutch, multiple speakers of Dutch, is relatively low is true. I've lived in Brussels, I've seen those people come in. Very often they work in their office. I'm talking cliche times, but you leave the train station, in a number of cases you don't even have to leave the building. There is a direct elevator from your car park to your office. You work until 4 o'clock, you go down to the car park, and you try to be on the highway as quickly as possible, on the motorway as quickly as possible. Which has raised a number of questions on the extent to which Flanders is willing to engage itself in Brussels. To what extent are you willing to show a commitment? Politicians usually say, no, this is our capital as well. We are fully willing to continue to support this, but to round up with a kind of catchphrase on Bourbon, not everyone in either part of the country loves the capital. And many people even tend to think we do not want that capital anymore. They can have it. We would be as well off without the capital as with it. It's not our world.
I'm a historian of Belgian Congo, and I was fascinated to hear your talk. And it's interesting, in the Congo, a lot of Africans started to learn Dutch as a way of circumventing and making fun of the administration because they couldn't do anything about it. My question, and what I want to contact you further to talk about perhaps, is how this language conflict is transposed into Belgian Congo. I think that's a really fascinating area, and I realise I might not get time to talk about it all now, but I'd love to talk more later, perhaps over email or so forth.
As I said, it's a topic which fascinates me, but I'm not competent in that domain. I would say I'm innocent, but it's something I only have reading knowledge of. I can point you to a number of articles, and some scholarship. There is some scholarship on this, rather controversial, of course. But one of the things you mentioned, for example, is that Dutch was used as a language to ridicule the colonizers. That is true up to a certain extent. It has been claimed that Dutch was used by colonizers as a kind of secret language.
Mm.
When the locals were not supposed to understand what people were discussing, then I haven't got the evidence, but it's a claim I've read in a number of articles. People reverted to Dutch to discuss this. Then again, it appears that in the 1950s, a number of local people in power in the Congo clearly said it would be French or nothing. We're not going to accept Dutch. And former dictator Mobutu, in his famous report, have said, well, if we got speakers of Dutch, we have recognition for the language here, let's then recognize these 200 some other languages we have in Congo as well.
Please don't know anything ahead, and I don't want to ask a provocative question.
Please do.
But World War II, did the Nazis play on the differences between the two communities?
I'm happy you asked that question. It's something I usually elaborate upon, but as I focused on the Francophonie more than the speaks of Dutch, I left it out. Both World Wars have been very sorry episodes for the Flemish movement. During the First World War, 1914-1918, a number of people, which favoured the Flemish cause, which we inverted commas, the term collaboration is not used, but did a number of things together with the Occupy. And that reflected in a very unfavourable way on any attempt to do something in favour of Dutch immediately after the First World War. In the Second World War, there was serious, I won't use the term massive, but it was serious collaboration with the Nazis in Belgium. And one of the often heard urban myths is that Flanders collaborated up to a far larger extent than Wallonia, that there was hardly any collaboration at the other side of the language board. We now know that's not true. I mean, that was known before that. There was collaboration in Flanders, and there also was serious collaboration in Wallonia. De Gael, for example, with his Rex party, obviously collaborated with the Germans, even tried to prove that the Walloons were also a Germanic people.
Not worse than in France themselves.
Situation was different. It's hard to compare. What is true is that at the Flemish side, at the Dutch-speaking side, a substantial part of the Flemish movement got involved into collaboration. Not the whole Flemish movement. But a number of people saw, especially towards the right-wing side, of course, saw the German occupier as a gateway to their goals, to achieving their goals. And in that context, for example, it's worth to mention that the University of Ghent sorry, no, I'm saying something wrong. In that context, it's worth mentioning that in a number of cases, serious cultural collaboration, and further than that, was established. A number of literary icons of Dutch literature, of Flemish literature, saw no problem at all in accepting honorary medals, honorary diplomas from the occupy. Now, I'm not a scholar of...
is remembered now.
Well, it's a fact. It's a fact.
In debates.
Yeah, it's a fact that's remembered in debate. It was most certainly remembered immediately after the Second World War, mm-hmm. when it seriously troubled the public discussion, and the discussions were mainly happened behind closed doors, and then eventually ended up with the territoriality principle. It's something which is sometimes still mentioned in a very unpleasant way. I give one example. There used to be in the 70s. A mayor in one of the communes of Brussels, who the political party, which still is there nowadays, which had huge posters in Brussels saying "Brussel Vlaams," Brussels Flemish. This never, and that was written in Faktur, so German typeface. And you got the impression if you saw that it was a Second World War poster. "Brussel Vlaams," this never. In a number of cases. But that's on the more radical side of the spectrum. People tend to refer to that war past. I won't say it's a major factor nowadays, but if it can be abused by radical factions, I stress radical factions, mm-hmm. Which of course are not the majority of the debaters, that can still happen nowadays. But that's something which was more the case in the past, especially after the Second World War.
Thank you. You mentioned urban myths and some Second World War. As a historian, do you have any knowledge of this so-called during the First World War, French speaking officers commanding Flemish speaking troops, etc.? Is that an urban myth, or does it have a basis in fact?
There has been, I said not an historian, no. But there has been scholarship and research,
yes.
which shows that the picture was far more nuanced than has usually been put forward. That you should be far more careful about those things than people have usually been. It was not as extreme as mean. A number of officers, for example, who were dominantly French-speaking, dominantly Dutch-speaking, you do see a difference. If you look at the number of plain simple soldiers who were Dutch-speaking and French-speaking, you do see the difference. So there is some truth to the myth. But as said, the myth as extreme as it has been used, as it has been abused, shouldn't be used in that way. But I do wish to stress that it still is very difficult nowadays, as a historian, to try and attack those myths. Because people, and a number of people, especially of older generations, feel incredibly offended and will even abuse you of very, very unkind things. I can say, for example, that I've been doing research on 19th century Belgium and 19th century farmers, official languages and 19th century farmers. One of the things I've seen in my research is that the myth of the complete Frenchification of the Flemish administration is a myth. It's simply not true. The facts are clear. If you try and move this forward, I do get the reaction from a number of people. Well, you should consider whether you should stress this in such an explicit way. You might want to find another way of rephrasing this. You might want to consider whether a project application on this topic is a useful thing to do, and whether there are no other topics which are far more urgent.
Can I ask you what this, I promise you, is my last question. The last the elections of 2010-11 were presented in terms of Flemish language, French language, but in fact the results came out where you had very much in Flanders a right-wing party, and in Wallonia you had a party that is much more, let's say, left-wing or Marxist, according to whatever. Is that the linguistic speakers of the Flemish language tend to be more right-wing, or is that... I realise that that's a very difficult question to answer, but the best question is always the difficult one.
My easiest answer would be that I'm no scholar of political science and that I can only answer as an inhabitant of the country myself.
Yeah. But you've got a better answer now, I suspect.
I'll try and cite a few observations which may try and with which I may try and answer or try and give an answer to your question. There has been historically an ideological difference. There have been different ideological tendencies at the Dutch-speaking side and the French-speaking side of the border. In cliché terms, Flanders has very often been perceived as Catholic territory, Wallonia as socialist territory. The election results, especially in Wallonia, still point in that direction. Socialist Party still gets a huge amount of votes. Is Flanders, by definition, more right-wing than Wallonia? I think that it's very hard to say. What you can say is that there has been, at various times in history, a small core which tended to go in that direction. People very often refer to the town of Antwerp, where a number of historical events in that direction started. I won't ever say that one person is by nature more right-wing than another. I do not believe in this, but you see various tendencies. As to the recent success of the nationalist, I stress, democratic nationalist party during the past two elections, so the most recent one, the communal elections, you can ask yourself, why does this party get so many votes? And I'm sure that scholars, which are far more competent than I am, are doing that right now. As a linguist, what interests me is the present-day conflict still related to language? Can you bring this down to language? Can you actually say it's because of the linguistic opposition, because of language problems? And I do not think that is the case.
Because that type of question is to be expected. There is always a few slides you keep as a... You say for the question session. I see that there's persistent political pressure for a new phase of state reform at both sides of the border, language border. And there are tendencies towards radicalization at both sides of the language border as well. In Flanders, a major part of this tendency is now captured by a nationalist party. At the French-speaking side, you see those tendencies, but they are present in the major political parties. There is one party, Front Démocratique pour la Francophone, for which this is the key issue, but you also find that tendency in the other political parties. And you get a number of silly expressions at both sides from politicians. Former Prime Minister, who famously claimed that the Francophones are intellectually incapable of learning Dutch, and then one of the major politicians at the other side of the language border reacted and said, well, that may be the case, but you are incapable of simply understanding us. The question is this something to do with language? And I do not think that this conflict is of a linguistic nature. There are a number of exceptions. I'll grant the people who claim this that. Language used in official context, clearly government context, that is to do with language. In certain facility communes, mayors refuse to do what they should do, as said by law, and, for example, send out letters to invite you to the elections in both languages, whereas it should be sent out in one language only, and then you have to ask for it in French. That kind of provocations. Language used in hospitals in Brussels. If you go to an emergency service at night, you may have trouble. You are bound to have trouble to get someone to find a nurse who speaks Dutch, unless you go to the hospital which my university runs, and you won't be in any trouble. So if you ever are in Brussels, go to the university hospital in Brussels or the VUB, and you'll be fine. At the Flemish side, there have been a number of discussions concerning social housing. A number of communes said, if you want social housing, you can get it, but we expect you to learn Dutch, or we expect you to be a speaker of Dutch. This has now been overruled to a certain extent. That is to do with language. But the main discussions are on the split of the social security system, which doesn't have anything to do with language, or investments in railroad structure, or tax advantages, or how are we going to regularize political refugees. Those are the major issues dividing Flemish parties and Walloon parties. And this has nothing to do with language nowadays anymore. The conflict clearly started out on a clear linguistic basis and was very much related to language issues. But over decades, centuries, as I said, you've had an evolution towards what I call les deux solitudes. And the question you can ask yourself then is, what are we facing now? Are we facing a conflict between language groups, between speakers of languages, or are we facing a conflict between what? Between cultures? Between communities? And how should you try and define the opposition? That is a question which is very tricky, and if you try and answer that question, you are bound to say things which you regret very soon afterwards. One last element to prove that the discussion is not about language. As hilarious as can be, but there was a discussion. We have a central authority governing all issues related to the Islam in Belgium. It's a religious authority. And it used to be a national authority. And a couple of years ago, there was a huge discussion because the Central Belgian Muslim Authority called for a split in a Flemish section and a Walloon section. Because the Flemish Muslims didn't want to have to do anything to do anymore. They wanted no more dealings with the corrupt Walloon Muslims. Apparently, the Flemish conception of Islam was so different from the French-speaking section of Islam, interpretation of Islam, that they had to split up. A similar discussion came up in the National Order of Architects, where the Flemish view on architecture apparently was so divergent from the Walloon view on architecture that they wanted to split up into factions. This has nothing to do with language anymore, but with other matters. And the discussion of those matters, I happily leave to specialists of those matters.
I'm just going to make a comment, really. Although I would say, as a Scot, of course, all these discussions of countries splitting has a lot of resonance. You began your narrative, where I end, you began your narrative in the 14th century. And the interesting thing about French at that time is it's not just dominant for your part, but it's dominant in Western Europe. It is the dominant vernacular in Western Europe. Now, it clearly has a particular status in areas where French is meeting German in some ways. And the development of medieval French in Wallonia is itself very interesting and in some ways rather weird, actually. So language contact is obviously influencing the development of that particular dialect. But amongst the upper echelons of society, it's not just in Belgium, or what is now Belgium, that French is the high prestige language.
This is something Madeleine van Strien also stressed in her talk on the position of French in Europe, and she gave a number of excellent quotes in that respect, where it becomes clear that in the whole of Europe, some people say ever since the Austrians took power in the 18th century, French became the most important language for clear philosophical reasons. That, of course, made the language struggle in what was to become Belgium even fiercer and harsher. Because you have a struggle between two languages, and if you have such a high difference in prestige, all internal national elements, so to say, are then even reinforced and become even more loaded because of the international impact of that language. Interesting nowadays is that the situation is changing. The international status of French still is very high, in diplomacy, for example. If you speak with diplomats in the European Union who have been around for 20 to 30 years and you ask them, how has the position shifted, how has it changed, it is very clear that 20 years ago people would still say French still is very, very important next to German and English. Nowadays, ever more you will get the reply, we still use French, and it can still be important in a number of contexts, but it's become clear that English has been on the rise. And you can also see that. Look at the efforts both Germany and France are making to secure the position of their mother tongues in the European context. And, I mean, the evolution is there are a number of factors which have led to this evolution, but the
the way the European Union has evolved obviously is a factor. Many people thought when the Union opened up towards Central Europe, former Eastern Europe, that that would have given a major boost to Germany, which, as a matter of fact, may have been the case in the first years, because many people there still had German from former times. But that has completely shifted. A new generation has come in, and you see that the importance of English there has increased enormously.
I want to just ask one question myself, although we must finish very soon, a linguistic question. In Russia, the use of French had obviously an impact on the Russian language. And I'm wondering whether this proximity of French to Dutch had rather different impacts on the Dutch spoken in the Netherlands on the one hand and the Dutch spoken in Flanders on the other. And whether, in fact, it's a conjecture, there might have been a greater reluctance to introduce French borrowings into Dutch within Flanders, which was far closer, than within the Dutch spoken and the Dutch spoken within the Netherlands.
The evolution has been different, most obviously, because it's clear that the standardization process of Dutch in the north and the south evolved in various ways, in different ways. And up to a certain extent, up to a large extent, that very much is true. Some people claim that the standardization of Southern Dutch only rekindled between the two world wars. You can discuss on that topic. I won't go into this. I think that's a rather pessimistic point of view. But it's very clear that Southern Dutch had its fair serious share of Gallicisms. And that has been noted ever since the 19th century. There are publications from 19th century onwards talking about Gallicism, which should be kept out of the language, weed, which has to be cut out because it is strangling the language. And even up until the present day, you can note a certain amount of Gallicisms in Flemish Dutch. They are marked in our standard reference works as Gallicisms, but they do exist, most certainly. So if you listen to the Dutch spoken by, for example, ministers, and in the 1960s, Dutch-speaking ministers, you will hear a kind of Dutch with much French interference on the lexical level, especially Gallicist interference. That's a completely different lecture, and I could easily elaborate for hours on that. I won't do that, but you can say that the influence of French on the vocabulary and the daily languages in Flanders was far more substantial in the Netherlands, especially in the period up until the, let's say, 1980s.
Is a comment on that. The interesting thing is that there is a Francophonia for all of the world using French. There isn't the same thing for English. It's quite obvious that the French feel that their language is under attack, because what you spoke about Gallicisms to be eliminated, you got that. You still get that very much in French. There was Toubon, who was, I forget when he was, but the minister was dealing with Anglicisms in the French language. And these things are always symptomatic, I think, and I always note it, they're symptomatic of languages where they feel themselves under attack. Would you agree with that?
Well, there is a huge tradition of purism,
yes,
all over Europe. You have to have an excellent scholar in that domain at this very university. Nils Lange has written a number of books on the topic and a number of articles on the topic. So the purist strategies can be observed, I would say, in any situation of language contact, but in very many situations of language contact all over Europe. Some up to a higher extent, and some communities up to a higher extent than in others, but you will find it anyway, and it still lives on nowadays. In Belgium, you know, you have a number of people who are still on the lookout for Gallicisms in Dutch. You have people on the French-speaking side of the language border who are on the lookout for Belgicisms in French. And the reason is, there even is, well, there are a number of think, dictionaries of Belgicisms in French.
Well, I think we should finish now. We've gone on exceptionally late, which is an indication, I think, of the questions and interests that your talks stimulated. And once again, thank you very much indeed, Garrett. Can I just say, before we thank them finally, that there is another seminar next week. Usually there is a fortnight between our seminars, but because we have six seminars this term in the 10 weeks, we have one next week and then a break for a fortnight. And next week's, at the same time and in the same place, is on French culture in Spain and interest in the two cultures in Spain in the 19th century. So another seminar actually next week at 5:15. Thank you very much.